Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Devastating tornadoes bring death and destruction to the South this week. President Obama speaks to his birth and a royal wedding in London. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, residents watch the storm coming on, and Mayor Walt Maddox speaks to the tornado's wrath.
Wow, it just hit something over there.
Yeah. Did you see it?
It turned real black.
I don't know if I've ever seen in my life anything as destructive and as tragic as what has transpired in Tuscaloosa.
On Wednesday, President Obama released his long-form birth certificate in response to critics who have repeatedly called his birthplace into question. The president said the flap over his birth has been a major distraction for a country facing critical issues.
The dominant news story wasn't about these huge monumental choices that we're going to have to make as a nation. It was about my birth certificate.
And today in London, pomp and circumstance as Prince William and Kate Middleton were wed in a royal ceremony at Westminster Abbey. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek and the Daily Beast, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the devastation in the South? What are you thinking on the president and the birthers, Donald Trump, the royal wedding? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Eleanor Clift, contributor to Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Eleanor, I bet you don't get a fanfare like that every time you come on the air. It's great to have you.
No,
with us.
But I'm with all the royal hoopla, I'm beginning to feel like being left behind here.
Well,
I want to be commemorated.
Trumpets for you, Eleanor. Trumpets for you. And for you too, Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Welcome back to the show, Byron.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And hello, Jack. Jack, are you welling up this morning or I don't know, out walking the dog as the wedding goes on?
Well, I'm tempted to say, Tom, I am a Republican.
a Tory at last?
But I have enjoyed the ceremony.
Well, it has certainly had a lot of eyes glued to it. But I must say, in this country, the thing just keeping people wrapped all week long, the terrible, terrible destruction that we have seen in the South, tornado after tornado. I'm sure you've seen those weather maps. Unbelievable numbers, nearly 300 dead reported at this point, and maybe more to come. Here's Christopher England witnessing one of those ripping through Tuscaloosa on Wednesday, describing that scene to CNN.
You could see, you know, just different colors being sucked up into the tornado, and you knew that it was just ripping stuff up, and you just didn't know, what, but it was just unreal to see something that violent and something that massive, because it was just huge.
And left behind, here's Tuscaloosa's city clerk, Tracy Groom.
We have neighborhoods completely gone. We have stores completely gone. I mean, to the point where the roof line is gone. I mean, the rubble, it's like you just blew it up.
Byron York, I believe you're an Alabama-born boy. What are you thinking as you watch nature plow across the South day after day this week?
Well, I am born and raised. I actually lived 3 years in Tuscaloosa. I talked to my mom, I guess, late Wednesday evening and said, what are you doing? And she said, well, we're just waiting for another tornado. Didn't get one, although a big pine tree fell into the house. It's just astonishing. Biggest group of tornadoes, deadliest group of tornadoes in, 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's entirely appropriate for the president to go down to Tuscaloosa. This is really, really a terrible, terrible thing.
Hundreds of tornadoes, and with that peculiar kind of destruction, not like a hurricane that really hits everything, but these plow lines, many lines, but lines through neighborhoods, blocks, towns. Eleanor, what are you thinking as you watch them march across the South so destructively?
Well, I'm thinking that sort of extreme and violent weather that we've seen in recent years, you know, could be linked to climate change. And that connection has certainly been made with hurricanes. I think it's a less certain and direct connection with tornadoes, but I think it is something that people are going to be examining. And I'm thinking what the what are the insurance companies going to do about this? Are they going to have a specific tornado damage requirements when they insure people? And then, you know, technology. There's an article in USA Today about how we may be able to get alerts, tornado alerts, on our mobile devices. Now, you don't get a lot of warning, but to get that warning out, I think that's a very positive development and something that could become a feature of modern life as we go forward.
Just time to escape to the storm cellar. Having grown up on the prairie, I remember that very well, being there huddled in a corner with my grandmother as twisters would go by. Jack, it is interesting these days. I mean, we have, on the one hand, a news media that goes wild on, it seems, every weather-related event. And as Byron points out, you know, it's the worst, not ever, it's the worst in 35 or 40 years. But it does, we get the collective sense that we have terrible, terrible weather going on. And you can't help but wonder about what's going on planet-wise.
You can't. And I have a word that loomed into my consciousness this morning, just reading the paper, that the potential tornado activity is measured in a scale known as, quote, the energy helicity index. And helicity seems to be what's happened in the South. And I think more and more people are wondering how much of this helicity is due to natural causes and how much has been helped along by human activity.
Well, our thoughts are with all those in the South who have been hit by this, all the families, not only those with the many thousands of wounded, hundreds dead, but many, many out of homes now. Our thoughts very much with them as they cope. We will look more at this whole story on Monday, the science of what's going on with tornadoes and the aftermath and toll of what has happened in the South. I want to turn, if I may, to the president and his very unusual press conference this week for a sitting United States president to call the press and the country, the attention of the world, together to look at the circumstances of his birth. The president was bemused, also clearly kind of irritated to be coming back to this. Here he is at the press conference on Wednesday.
We do not have time for this kind of silliness. We got better stuff to do. I've got better stuff to do. We got big problems to solve, and I'm confident we can solve them, but we're going to have to focus on them, not on this.
Focus on the problems, not on this. Donald Trump had risen to a quite sudden prominence among potential contenders for the Republican nomination for the presidency in 2012, precisely on the back of his attack on the president's circumstances of the president's birth. Here he was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Wednesday, taking credit proudly for prompting President Obama to release that long-form birth certificate from Hawaii.
I am really honored, frankly, to have played such a big role in hopefully getting rid of this issue. Now, we have to look at it. We have to see, is it real? Is it proper? What's on it? But I hope it checks out beautifully. I am really proud. I am really honored.
Eleanor Clift, Donald Trump is really proud and really honored. If you didn't notice, he'll tell you. what do you think of this? Here the president is, you know, deep in his term as president. His birth certificate has been out there for a long time, but this issue absolutely did not go away in rather large numbers of the American public.
Right, and when you see polls that say that 4 out of 10 Republicans think that there's something, you know, fishy about his birth, and, you know, 18% of the country think that he's not born in the U.S., and another 30% have doubts, you see how this was creeping into the bloodstream of the electorate. I mean, I was glad to see the president, you know, show some really anger, because this is insulting to treat a man who's been elected president, who's leading the country, and to suggest somehow he's illegitimate because his birth certificate didn't suit his critics. And Mr. Trump can be honored, but how much honor is there to be proven wrong, that all your allegations have been proven wrong? And I imagine that's not going to stop Mr. Trump, perhaps, or others. And they're now raising questions about the president's academic record, questioning how he got into these elite institutions. And, you know, I'm tempted to say, if affirmative action played a role, that should be a vindication of that program. If we're turning out presidents with that program, it must be a pretty good deal. I mean, I think this has really bordered, the ridiculousness. And really, I think it's an embarrassment for the U.S. in the eyes of the world.
Byron York, do you think this puts an end to the issue?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. This really got started in the Clinton campaign. It got started in the long and brutal primary contest between Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton. And there was an internal document from that campaign that came out later where Mark Penn, Hillary Clinton's top advisor, said something to the effect of, I simply can't believe that in a time of war the people will nominate someone who has such shallow roots in the American experience. And that just grows and grows and grows.
Isn't that different from saying he's not an American?
Well, it is. It is, but you have to remember the whole birther stuff did come out of the fight for the Democratic nomination and then spun out of control. I think him releasing his birth or the long form of his birth certificate will put an end to all of that. And what we'll see is some fringe figures, Orly Tates, perhaps Donald Trump, Jerome Corsi, talking about this, but I don't think it'll be part of any conversation in the future.
Jack may have originated in some lines out of the Clinton camp, but clearly fed and nurtured actively or kind of passively by any number of Republican leaders over the years.
Yes, there's been some winking at it. But, this is only the most egregious misperception that the president has failed to correct. Majorities believe he's responsible for the TARP, that he raised rather than lower taxes, that the stimulus, which the CBO saved as many as 3 million jobs, failed. Now he's stopping messaging on the economy altogether, ceding that to the GOP. A great political scientist once wrote, "The definition of alternatives is a supreme instrument of power. He who says what politics is about runs the country." That would be the GOP now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, tornado chaos in the South. The president speaks to his birth, a royal wedding, a little royal wedding in London. Byron York is with us from the Washington Examiner. Eleanor Clift is here from Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Jack Beatty's here as well. And let's get our listeners right in here. Bob in Newmarket, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. I would just like to talk about the president's birth certificate. I'm a Republican. And I got to be honest, I'm kind of embarrassed about how my party has drug this into the ground. And I feel like politics every year or every presidential election just gets into the mud. You know, like President Bush's National Guard service, that kind of stuff, it distracts totally from the issue. And I just wanted to give my two cents in there.
Do you think the president's right that we've got bigger fish to fry, Bob?
Oh, yeah, definitely. No doubt about it.
I mean, I guess it's just patently obvious, but I appreciate your call very much, Bob. One more from Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, you're on the air, Stuart.
Yeah, it was just sad to see that the president had to come out with his birth certificate like that. It just proves that the policies of this country, as far as race are concerned, haven't changed since the 1890s. I mean, if his driver's license wasn't good enough for him to get into Harvard, and if his state ID, wasn't good enough for him to even buy a six-pack of beer. I mean, you can't even take your birth certificate in to buy a six-pack of beer nowadays. You know, it shows that the racial politics of this country really has not changed over the years. And for those people, who sat on the sidelines, those whites and black people who sat on the sidelines and just asked the question, why doesn't he show it? Well, you think about, those black people who had to go to the polls and prove their citizenship, that's why he didn't have to show it.
Stuart, I appreciate your call. This got raised in a couple of ways this week. Stuart says it's been raised by this whole affair. I mean, the issue of race sitting in here, Eleanor Clift, I have heard any number of African-Americans say in the days since the president came out, shake their heads and say, this is wrong. We've seen this before in many different ways, this kind of denial of legitimacy to African Americans. And here, even the elected president of the United States, you hear Stuart saying it's a comment on race and racism, I guess, in this country.
Well, I do think there's an element of race. But if you put it in the bigger picture. This country is undergoing a demographic change. We will be a country where minorities are the majority at some point in the not-too-distant future. And I think there's an element of the electorate that's really uncomfortable with that. They probably don't consider themselves racist, but the unease that they feel that their country no longer looks like it did when they were growing up and coming of age, I think feeds into this, that somehow there's some question, you know, how did this happen? How did someone with Barack Obama's, you know, name and his background become president? I mean, it's different from what we've experienced in the past. And so I think you see these birther bills going on across the country and really attempts to make it harder for, you know, minorities to vote. And, you know, I think it's very disturbing, and I think that the sort of rational majority in this country, I think, will resist that. But I think this is a phase that we're going through as we cope with the demographic changes in the country.
Donald Trump claimed a victory as the president rolled out his long-form birth certificate, but he then turned right away to his qualifications for the schools he attended, of course, all the way right up to Harvard Law School, immediately sort of turned in that direction. You had on CBS Bob Schieffer, a longtime veteran Washington correspondent for CBS, going after that here on the race front, talking with Katie Couric on Wednesday. Let's listen.
He said, we need to look at his grades and see if he was a good enough student to get into Harvard Law School. That's just code for saying he got into law school because he's black. This is an ugly strain of racism that's running through this whole thing.
Byron York, what do you make of that charge from Bob Schieffer right there?
Well, I certainly think Trump was trying to immediately change the subject because he had been proven wrong. He had said he had been hearing that there was no birth certificate, or it had some sort of embarrassing information. So everything Trump had been saying had been turned out to be incorrect, so he immediately changes the subject. A couple of thoughts on this. One thing you saw in this whole birther thing was an astonishing amount of ignorance about the law concerning natural-born citizens. The Constitution requires people to be natural-born citizens to be president. I spent a little time looking it up. You know, if a Barack Obama were born today, same circumstances, American mother, Kenyan father, if he were born outside the United States, in Kenya or Australia or anywhere, he would be a natural-born American citizen because his mother was a natural-born American citizen who lived here all of her life before his birth. So there was an extraordinary ignorance of the law. That being said, I do think the president could have ended this quite a long time ago by actually just authorizing the release of this thing. My personal feeling is he liked having the birthers around because it helped to delegitimize the opposition. You saw things like John Boehner, Speaker of the House, Eric Cantor, Majority Leader of the House, would appear on talk shows, and the host would ask them about the latest poll showing the number of people who believe the president's not born in the United States. This was actually something that was politically useful for the president and Democrats. I think it spiraled out of control when Donald Trump became the wild card in this, and it got kind of crazy. But the president actually could have authorized the release of this stuff quite a long time ago.
I want to turn and look at the Republican field shaping up for 2012, Trump and all the rest. A couple of calls first. Henry in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Henry. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm a natural citizen, and I've been in this country for 27 years, mm-hmm. and you know, this issue with the president, you know, I mean, they're asking for his citizenship is just ridiculous. And I think, you know, the world looks at America as a, you know, they always listen to what's going on in this country, and they hear something like this is just dividing people and very discriminating to me.
Henry, I'm glad for your call. I think a lot of people, I mean, many people have looked at it clearly and wondered on this issue, but many others, yourself obviously included, saying, why? What are people reaching for here? Let me get one more. Amherst, Massachusetts, Carl's calling. Hi, Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for putting me on. Mm-hmm. I had a thought about the royal wedding, which is that it kind of serves as part of a shared narrative for Britain in a way that we don't have in America. In Britain, they've got, like, their political parties, but they also have the constitutional monarchy, which is apolitical. Everyone agrees on that. here we have two narratives, a kind of collectivist and individualist narrative. And although we've got a constitution, there's really no personification of it.
I'm glad for your call, Carl. Jack, let me turn to you with that. I mean, Carl puts it on a collectivist, individualist sort of spectrum, maybe of polarity in this country. On the other hand, there was a moment, and it sort of seemed like Barack Obama's election, when there was a widely trumpeted theme in this country. You know, we've gotten over divides in this country. He's looking over to the royal wedding and seeing something that transcends politics. We had a moment in that election. I guess it wasn't obviously for everybody, but an awful lot of people felt we have finally transcended something. And maybe in the press conference this week, the message was, well, not entirely.
Not entirely. In fact, that night, the night of his inauguration, Stephen Colbert had a sign on his, ran beneath his face saying, racism, 1776 to 2008. Well, it wasn't, it clearly isn't that at all. For a substantial fraction of Republican voters, and not only Republicans, according to one recent poll, only 53% of independents were sure that the president, was a natural born citizen, have been scared out of their wits, literally, because to believe this is to sort of put ignorance on your forehead and just proclaim yourself beyond corrigibility by evidence. I want to disagree, though, with what Byron said, that, you know, that's a little bit like what Karl Rove was saying yesterday, which is, oh, the president wanted to encourage this and so on. You know, it could well be that it's helped him in some way, but I can't believe that they really wanted to encourage this, simply because it is for African Americans, for any American with a sensitivity to our injustices of our history, it's a degrading aspersion that should be out there.
Well, Jack, the president did make occasionally jokes about this, not just on Oprah, but he would joke about this. This was actually, I think, of some benefit to them until it went out of control with the Trump phenomenon. One mm-hmm. little more note, John McCain had to go to court to defend his natural-born citizenship. He was born in the Panama Canal Zone in 1936, had to go to court against a Democratic challenge. There were also questions about the citizenship of George Romney. Mitt Romney's father, who wanted to run for president, was born in Mexico, and Barry Goldwater, who was born in Arizona before it became a state. So these have been issues in presidential campaigns in the past.
Yeah, but those Eleanor. Issues weren't used against Romney or really McCain to try to discredit them. I mean, the use of the birther issue was really an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of Barack Obama in a very insulting way. And to add a little more perspective, I remember the Kerry campaign in 2004, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And the Kerry campaign aides initially, through the summer, really didn't respond because they thought they had a candidate with, you know, three medals of honor or three Purple Hearts against a candidate who didn't really serve, had a National Guard experience where maybe he didn't even show up. They thought it was ridiculous. And it took hold, and it injected this poison into the electorate, and I think it really hurt John Kerry, so that you had the candidate who had served with honor look like he was the one who was getting away with something. So I think the Obama White House let this go on the assumption that they and all their friends thought it was ridiculous, and then they saw it really leach into mainstream thinking, and I think it was taking a real toll. And I agree with Jack. This isn't something that the president would have encouraged. Sure, he made jokes about it because it was self-deprecating, but it's an insult. It's insulting to him and to, you know, African Americans that they can be questioned in this manner.
Let's go to Paul in Omaha, Nebraska. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to pick up on a couple of things. Somebody talked about the Trump phenomenon, and I'll identify myself first as being an independent voter.
Okay.
You know, I tend to lean Republican, but I certainly give the Democrats a fair shake. And honestly, I'm just so embarrassed by the whole Republican and conservative camp, you know, going after this birth certificate thing. And to take it one step further, the Trump phenomena that's been referred to, you know, to me this is almost becoming a carnival atmosphere. We're pushing the fringes of sanity on this whole thing. You know, we're bringing in reality TV show stars. Mm. You know, Trump is just, I'm not criticizing him as a human being, but he is almost a caricature of our society. And I have to believe that other countries are looking at us and just wondering what has come over us.
Paul, I appreciate your call. Let us look at that phenomenon of Trump certainly jumping up there in the Republican field, I guess you have to say, even in the polls. I appreciate your call, Paul. Byron York, what do you make of how Donald Trump has jumped into this? In some polls I've seen, he's showing up as a front runner among those Republicans who are out there now.
Well, I'm with Paul on this one. I think the Trump phenomenon is a joke, and I think it will pass at some point. You're beginning to see, I believe, yesterday or the day before, Rush Limbaugh talked at some length about how he does not believe Trump is a conservative. One explanation is that Trump's jump in popularity among the Republican primary electorate. Mm-hmm. One, it's a media-fed phenomenon. The media love him. They give him a lot of coverage. Two, it is an expression of lingering, continuing unhappiness with the Republican field as it exists, even though it really kind of doesn't exist right now. President Obama is almost running for re-election unopposed at this point. And I think that there is continuing unhappiness with the field, and someone like Trump takes temporary, I think it's going to be temporary, advantage of it.
Well, look at the field then, beyond Trump, if you like. Governor Haley Barbour of Mississippi pulling out this week, saying he, you know, sort of thought about it and realized he did not have the absolute fire in the belly that a candidate would require. His buddy, Mitch Daniels, Indiana, possibly getting in the race now. What's shaping up here, Byron? I think there's supposed to be some kind of GOP debate next week. Who's going to be there?
There is a debate sponsored by Fox News in Greenville, South Carolina on May 5th, which is next Thursday, I think. And Gingrich has announced that he's not going to be in it. Not clear whether Michelle Bachmann will be in it or won't be in it. Tim Pawlenty will be. Some of the lesser candidates, Buddy Romer, Herman Cain, Ron Paul, I guess, will be there. But the field is very unformed. But still, what you have shaping up is kind of the old Republican idea of the next guy in line. Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee finished second, tied for second the last time around. Romney's obviously running, is a front runner. Let's take Trump out of the equation for the moment. Huckabee, actually, I have a new column out about him today. A lot of speculation that he won't run. To tell you the truth, talking with people in his circle, not to Huckabee himself, I think he's going to get in it. I think he's more and more tempted by his place in the polls. Then you have Pawlenty trying to actually break into this a newcomer position. Polls show that almost nobody knows who he is. And Gingrich clearly still has problems. He's always going to have problems. He's someone who alienates about half of the people and the other half like him. That's a problem for a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Sarah Palin thing. My guess is she's not going to be in it.
Jack, Byron describes the president as almost unopposed at this point. Does that mean an Obama romp to re-election?
I don't think so at all. I mean, earlier I quoted that line, the definition of alternatives is the supreme instrument of power. Consider this. With 14 million unemployed, with polls showing a third of Americans, a third believe we're in a depression, with jobs still the number one priority, mm-hmm. according to polls for the public, the president should be defining alternatives this way. Do you want years of unconscionably high unemployment or rapid growth and broad prosperity? Instead, it's the GOP alternatives, bankruptcy or austerity, that rule. You know, it's no wonder that 57% of people now disapprove of the president's handling of the economy. He's given up on jobs. Congress has. The Fed has. The Washington elite has turned its back on the people.
Oh, Eleanor Clift, 1.8% growth in the first quarter. That's not exactly thriving there. Is the economy as big a challenge for the president as any Republican?
No, and it's really not clear what the president can do about it. I mean, he does travel the country and, you know, talk up green energy and his investments in education. He's basically just trying to stave off cuts in the programs or investments that he cares about, which is, I think, part of the reason why Trump has been getting a hearing. He makes it all sound so easy. He says, you know, the president is just the worst president in history ever. He doesn't know how to create jobs. You know, he does. He does on television, I guess, or he knows how to fire people. And as for oil, he would just go over there and take their oil. And he likes the wars the way they used to be fought. We won and we got to keep everything. I think, you know, it's appealing to people to make them think it could be as easy as Trump is advertising. In the end, he's not going anywhere, but it's a kind of a fantasy.
We got a short break right here. Eleanor, Byron York, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point on the Week. We'll be right back.
In other news this week, astronaut Mark Kelly today is scheduled to captain the space shuttle Endeavour in its last launch. His wife, Representative Gabrielle Gifford, still recovering from her shooting in Tucson in January, will be there to watch him.
She's been working really hard to make sure that her doctors would permit her to come, and she's more than medically ready to be here, and she's excited about making this trip.
In India, thousands mourn the death of spiritual guru Sai Baba, who died at 85.
Sai Shraddhaya Vidmahe Satya Devaya Dhimahi.
And Grammy-nominated singer Phoebe Snow died this week at the age of 60. In the mid-70s, she scaled back her music career to care for a disabled daughter. Here she is with her 1974 hit single, Poetry Man. Looking at a week in the news, tornado chaos in the South, the president speaking out this week on his birth, the royal wedding in London, and of course, the situations that go on in Libya, in Syria. We're with Eleanor Clift of Newsweek and the Daily Beast, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a call from Eric in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Eric, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have an interesting perspective on the disaster that hit. One, I'd like to give credit to the weathermen who really accurately predicted the danger zone of where the tornadoes were going to strike. I was watching the Weather Channel basically all week. Anybody that's been traveling anywhere through this region, the Ohio Valley region, and everything with the flash flooding, it's been a nightmare trying to get anywhere. They've canceled prom in my hometown. My daughter, they've had to reschedule it because of flooding. The other thing that gives promise is during travels on my I-65 towards Louisville this morning, I passed convoy of bucket trucks, line trucks, linemen on their way to go assist to help power back on in Georgia, Alabama. And what that says to me is they're not waiting for federal people. They're already on their way down there. And that's the number one thing you have to remember during disaster relief. You got to have power. Power to run the government, power to run the fire station,
sure.
power to run everything. And those guys are already on their way. They're coming from several states over, several states north. And you're talking to someone whose father worked 42 years as a lead lineman in his community.
Yes.
Now he trains linemen at the Somerset School in Kentucky. My brother actually is on his way. He works in West Virginia. He's on his way down there to help the people that has been destroyed, or lives have been destroyed, power knocked out by this by these rounds of storms. And I have to say, the old saying is kind of a weird saying, but even firemen need heroes, and that is the people they call right before they start pouring water on a building when it's on fire is an electrician, a lineman who climbs a pole or gets in a bucket, gets up there, kills the power so they can put the power out.
Eric, I'm glad for your call. It's going to take a lot of linemen and a lot more to bring this back to life, but I'm happy to hear of convoy after convoy that you see heading down there already. It's funny, I was just down last week with my daughter and a group putting a roof back on a house blown off in that earlier line of storms that had come through down on the Kentucky border in West Virginia, and saw plenty of people working then, but now it's going to take a whole lot more, and we hope that many, many people turn out to actually do that. I'm glad you see convoys on the way there, even today already, and I appreciate your call. I want to hear just a little bit from what congressmen have been hearing when they went back home after the whole big budget debate. Of course, there's much more of that to come. Here's a little tape from, this was Tuesday, Republican Congressman Dan Webster, freshman from Florida, faced a rowdy crowd in a town hall meeting in Orlando. Some voiced anger over his attempts to talk about Paul Ryan's budget plans, the Republican budget plans. Others in the hall tried to drown out those protesters with their chanting. You'll get a flavor of it here. He's not doing his job to represent me, says the one voice. Then let him talk, comes back from the other side. Byron York, what are you seeing, hearing of what Republicans are, and Democrats for that matter, are hearing as they go back home for this recess on the whole budget conflict we just had so much of in Washington?
Well, Congress has been on a two-week Easter recess, mm-hmm. so they've been back in their districts having town halls. We heard this one with Dan Webster in Florida. There was one, Paul Ryan, the committee, House Budget Committee chairman mm-hmm. and the author of the Republican budget, has been doing them in Wisconsin. And he has had a couple of occasions where people have done similar things. Overall, I think that you can say that I think there was kind of a desire among Democrats to get maybe some like an August 2009 phenomenon going when we saw a lot of people very unhappy with the proposed national health care plan go to their town halls and give their representatives a piece of their mind. We've had a little bit of that. It has not been an actual phenomenon.
Eleanor Cliff, do you think that the Congress people are going to come back strengthened in their positions after talking with their constituents at home or tempered by what they hear?
I think each side comes back strengthened. The Democrats who did not vote for the budget plan are looking at this as a political loser for Republicans. And Republicans who voted for it now feel like they have to double down. I don't think they can walk away from that vote. But the polls show that even Tea Party, people who identify with the Tea Party, really don't want, you know, major changes to Medicare. And I think the previous experience with President Bush wanting to privatize Social Security, and that didn't work too well, I think has basically laid the groundwork here for a lot of resistance to what is seen as essentially turning Medicare into a private voucher plan. So I think that's not going to happen, and the two parties are going to have to get together somehow and come up with a broad roadmap going ahead in order to get the debt ceiling raised. But I think the Ryan plan is effectively dead.
Jack, Ryan plan dead? Do you see a broad roadmap emerging here? They've got to do something on that debt ceiling, and yet it's the sort of the lines in the sand that people seem to be prepared, at least on the right. I don't know about President Obama, but by which to define the contest in 2012.
Yes, and not only with the Republicans. Kent Conrad, the budget chairman in the Senate, has said that he is not going to vote for raising the debt ceiling without some kind of agreement on a package, a framework. Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, has joined him. So I think all eyes are on this gang of six in the Senate that is supposedly talking about a grand bargain. Now, of course, nothing can be finalized before the debt ceiling vote, but a framework that would, point them toward future action. I think that's really the frail hope that people have, that certainly the financial markets have, that we'll get by this crisis.
Let's go to Richard in Westboro, Massachusetts. Richard, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Your screen is allowing me to do a redirect on Donald Trump, because I'm not talking about the birthers issue. Kind of as a corollary to what Ms. Cliff said about the Swiss boat movement, it seems to me that every man and woman to a fault in the Republican and Democratic Party, all media analysts, many of us here in the public are not taking Mr. Trump seriously. We're careful of what we don't wish for, because it could happen. I'm not trying to be apocalyptic about this, as if he's the charismatic figure supposedly predicted to arise, or that this is a kind of a Hitler moment. But this guy is a megalomaniac. He has a grandiose personality, and he is preying on the public fears and anxieties. The first thing he does in a press conference 2 days ago, after the president trots out the very valid birth certificate, it's not just the academic grades. He starts talking about strong-arming and doing leverage tactics against China and OPEC and Saudi Arabia. I think that it is to our peril if we don't take this guy seriously.
Let me hold that, Richard, and get one more on the GOP field. But we take your point. Jeff in Greenville, South Carolina. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think the reason that people are interested in somebody like Donald Trump is because they're tired of the same old personnel that the GOP is trying to run, and they're looking for some change. I think that's why Obama got elected last time. People wanted some change, and they're not seeing anything new coming out of the Republican Party as far as candidates.
Let us pick it up, Jeff. Jack Beatty, Byron says, he's not serious. It's a media sort of event that makes Trump up in the polls. But then you hear our caller, Richard, saying, well, be careful. In tough times, you can get some candidates you might not expect otherwise. What do you think, Jack?
Well, you know, one is tempted to just laugh at it. I thought Chris Rock's one-liner was priceless. He said, I wouldn't vote for Trump. I'd be afraid he was going to leave us for a younger, prettier country.
Oh, no.
But I take his point. David Brooks says what people see in Trump is the gospel of success. You know, they that's what's involved here. People just like the idea of this fellow that's, of course, the gospel of success, that's an Andrew Carnegie line. Carnegie rose from nothing, from nothing to the heights. Mr. Trump was born on third base. So it's hard to see him as really exemplifying that. But there's some element there of what people are calling the Republican or maybe conservative id, some unconscious forces that he clearly, at least for the moment, represents. And I think that, frankly, in any debate, when he shows his extensive ignorance of public policy, and he doesn't seem to know a thing about the world, and then when stuff comes out about his life, his business dealings, and so on, he will fade. And Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC seems to be indicating, who's connected to NBC, that this is all just a joke, that this is just to promote, and the NBC knows it. This is just to promote his show, and he isn't going to run.
But, you know, the unhappiness with the field that Richard was talking about is there, and that's why you do see a longing for someone like Chris Christie, who has said he's not going to run, or Mitch Daniels, to get into this race. I mean, there is this longing in the Republican Party for someone to come in and be, you know, the superstar. I think Trump is trading on that in a very temporary way.
Speaking of somebody to come in, Eleanor Clift, the president, is proposing a big reshuffle of his national security chiefs this week. David Petraeus, from heading up the effort in Afghanistan to head the CIA, and then Leon Panetta from the CIA to replace the Secretary of Defense this summer at the Pentagon. What do you see going on with this shift, Eleanor?
Well, they're all familiar faces who have proven themselves in the eyes of this president and indeed the country. And I think moving Leon Panetta to the Defense Department suggests to me that there are some significant cuts in defense spending ahead.
He's a budget guy.
He's a budget cutter. He was OMB head during the Clinton era. He was a Republican congressman initially, and he was a big budget cutter when he was on Capitol Hill decades ago. And he knows how the bureaucracy works, and I think, as he himself said, I know what works in Washington. I also know why things don't work. And so and Bob Gates actually suggested him as his replacement, even though Secretary Gates has been opposed to making deeper cuts. So I think that's a very interesting switch. And then putting Petraeus at the CIA, I gather he's going to resign from the military, so he will be former military when he takes over. But it does bring the intelligence service closer to the military, and it's the kind of war that this president seems to be more comfortable with, and that's, you know, covert operators, drones without pilots, where you keep American casualties down.
Byron, Bob Gates, Secretary Gates, has proposed some $400 billion in cuts at the Pentagon. The President Obama is looking for $400 billion more. Do you see bipartisan support emerging for that as we look at the country's very large fiscal challenges now?
Well, you probably see it for Gates's suggestions. As a matter of fact, Paul Ryan in his budget wanted to stay right within the confines of the specific things that Gates has suggested, which involves some spending cuts and some redirection of money, taking money away from some programs that are wasteful and moving into other defense programs that might be more useful. But I think, as a minimum, the cuts that Gates has suggested are going to be a position of a lot of Republicans.
Let me get one more call. Joseph in Iowa City, Iowa. Joseph, you're on the air. Make it quick, my friend. Our time is short.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom. I just want to make the quick point that I think it's kind of disgusting how much we're glorifying this royal wedding when all the other stuff that's going on in the world. I feel like it's kind of just a legacy of colonialism that we're glorifying when we can look around the world and see the negative effects that colonialism is still having. And that's all I want to say. Thanks.
I appreciate your call. A lot of palaces built, Jack, on the imperial loot brought home. We kicked the royals out, and yet so many televisions tuned in today. You can't cut a line through it.
You can't. And we had an expert on Syria on our show this week who said, you know, what's happening now there and throughout the Middle East is the shakeout of the maps and the ruling mm-hmm. systems that the colonial powers installed after the First World War. So I take that point indeed. But watching this extravaganza, I can only think of Shakespeare, you know, this royal throne of kings, this scepter dial, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England. Ah, it'll always be in England.
Well, nobody immune maybe to the desire for a little fairy tale time. Things are plenty tough in this world. Our thoughts this week very much with those people in the streets in Syria, with everybody in the South who's been hit by all the tornadoes this week. We hope for a speedy recovery there. I want to thank our guests for being with us today. Byron York with the Washington Examiner. Byron, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Eleanor Clift with Newsweek and the Daily Beast. It's been great to have you again, Eleanor. Come again soon.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, all right. Sorry, Joseph in Iowa City, but here's a little more, just a little, from the royal wedding, the hymn Jerusalem in Westminster Abbey today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.